in truth, I don't think very much about the reader because that's what I find inhibiting. I really just think if I draw it and write it and I laugh, then that's the best I can hope for.
Hello and welcome to In Writing with me, Hattie Crissell. And the voice you heard there was the comic book and children's picture book writer and illustrator, Tor Freeman. Tor is a very close friend of mine and somebody that I've been really excited to bring to the podcast because I've been lucky to have many hours of conversation about creativity with her over the last decade or so, and a lot of those conversations have directly helped my work. So I hope that many of you will get something useful out of this episode. Tor started her career illustrating and writing books for children. Her first with a writing credit was 2002's Ra, and some other favourites of mine and of the children in my life are Olive and the Big Secret, The Toucan Brothers and Digby Dog Delivers. While they're all very sweet, just as they sound, the important thing to say about Tor is that she's a very funny writer and illustrator and also a great observer of life. So even though her characters are often cats or indeed toucans, they display a lot of really relatable human qualities like embarrassment, foolishness, overconfidence and self-doubt. Over the last several years, she's turned to writing and drawing comics as well, including Welcome to Oddly, which is a sort of buddy cop mystery starring a cat and a rat, and Sister Claudetta, Murder at the Monastery, about a nun detective. I went over to Tor's flat in October 2022 and we talked about inspiration and the very varied places that she finds it, the benefits that she gets from making some of her work available for free, and what her second wave of creative success as a comic book writer and artist has taught her. Before we get started, this season of In Writing is sponsored by Curtis Brown Creative, the writing school from the literary and talent agency Curtis Brown. Curtis Brown Creative run inspiring and practical courses to help you find your voice and unleash your imagination. If you're inspired by today's interview, you might want to join their 10-week online course in writing and illustrating a children's picture book. Award-winning illustrator Sarah McIntyre and best-selling author David O'Connell guide you through the unwritten rules of children's picture book creation. It's perfect for beginners, budding writers, or artists looking to try a new medium. In Writing listeners get an exclusive discount, so use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off the full price of writing and illustrating a children's picture book or any other short online course. Visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. I'll be back at the end of the episode, but for now, over to Tor. So this is the room where you sew, but also importantly for this conversation, you do your illustration and writing.
Yes, that's right. So it's a square room with one big window and half of it is turned over to my sewing hobby and the other half is for my drawing and writing.
Okay, and you've got a great view as well because we're on the 8th floor.
That's right, yeah. So looking south, I'm in Shepherd's Bush near the Green, and looking south, yeah, I've got a view for quite a long way over London.
So tell me, describe a little bit what we can see around us now, particularly in the, you know, when you're sitting at your desk and you're illustrating.
So I've got quite a big IKEA desk with a computer, a Wacom tablet, which is what I draw digitally with, a light box, and then various pens, pencils, bits of paper. And then on the wall, I've got my sort of wall of inspiration, which is books and pictures that I look at to inspire me.
It's fabulous, your wall, and there's loads of stuff on there. Would you talk to me a bit about what are the things in here that you love the most and enjoy having around you the most?
Oh, that's a good. Well, I've got some printouts of my favourite artists. So I've got a drawing by Charles Adams, who was a New Yorker cartoonist, and he did the Adams Family. He was the original drawer and creator of the Addams Family. So I've got a picture from them. I've got a printout by Ronald Searle, some pictures from The Complete Molesworth, which he illustrated, and some pictures by Maurice Sendak. So when I'm struggling with my line or to draw people, I look at those pictures. So they give me a lot of pleasure. I've got a picture of Popeye, who's always an inspiring character.
That's framed. Where did you get that framed from?
The Popeye picture, yes, it's a screen print. I got it in a fair. I mean, it's a man who makes Popeye prints but isn't the original drawer, who is Seagar. And yeah, I just like it. I mean, anything that reminds me of sort of old comics or old animations from when I was young, I always like to see.
What's this lovely sort of embroidered...
Oh, that's by Janet Bolton, who is a textile artist. She does, I'm blanking on the word, but embroidered pictures. And my mother and I went to a class of hers in Richmond to learn to do some of this embroidery. And we didn't do anything very spectacular, but her work is absolutely lovely.
And also you've got a movie poster here.
Yeah, that was purchased and came as part of the longest hangover of my life. I was drinking and eBaying, which of course should never be done. And so I bought a picture. I was on a Rocky Horror Show and Meatloaf kick, and I bought a framed, not just a poster of the Rocky Horror Show, but framed. So it cost me about £120, and a tear from a magazine interview with Meatloaf and something else. I can't even remember. And basically, when I woke up the next day with a terrible hangover, all that week things kept arriving in the post that I'd ordered. But the Rocky Horror Picture Show poster turned out to be a good buy.
That was a good purchase.
That was a good buy. The Meatloaf tear from the magazine, not so much.
Did you keep it though?
I kept it for a while because it had cost me about £15, I think. So I was a bit...
Probably more valuable now.
That's true. It was.
May he rest
in peace. R.I.P. Meatloaf. Yes, exactly.
So what are you working on at the moment?
At the moment, I am finishing up a picture book called Dog Done It, which was written by Peter Bentley. And I am doing my normal work, which is illustrations for a French magazine called Tralalia.
Okay. So I tend to hear you describe yourself as an illustrator, but you are, of course, a writer as well. Do you think of yourself as a writer?
I do. Yes, yeah. I do now. I didn't when I started my career, but I've done quite a bit of writing and become much more interested in it as time has gone on, and would like have aspire to write more.
Yeah. And so you've published, I think, 41 books. Either you've just illustrated them or you've illustrated and written them, which is pretty impressive. That's quite a lot of books. And the ones that you know, all of your work is absolutely beautiful, but the ones that you write are so funny. And also, I think you're brilliant at plotting. And you're very good at coming up with a storyline, and which I find really difficult. So
thank you.
How did this visual part of your work and the more writerly parts of your work come together? And do they happen simultaneously? Or is there a note-taking, more writing part? Or talk me through it.
They come, I think probably at the moment, the visuals always come first. I tend to think better when I'm drawing something, and I tend to think of an image or a character that I want to write a story about. I think it would be more efficient if I could just write first and make notes. And I've tried to do that. For example, with making comics, I know that there are writers or comic book makers who write out scripts and texts and then work from that. The problem with the way I work is that I can end up doing a lot of drawings for something that won't work as a story, or the plot fails. And then I've spent a lot of time and effort on a lot of drawings that have nowhere to go. And I sense that if I could just do it in text, it would be quicker and I would find out faster if something wasn't going to work.
But you can't, because you need to visualise things.
I think so. I have that sense that characters, once they exist, will then write their own words. And until I can see them in front of me, I don't know what they're going to say.
I love that.
Yeah. It sounds a bit cosmic, but I've read so much about this feeling of this act of creation, and I have experienced it so much myself that it no longer feels sort of whimsical to me, because I see it in action. It definitely happens.
What do you think is going on there?
I think it's a sort of virtuous circle that you make a character, they say something that might suggest the next movement they take or the next drawing, which then suggests something else that they say. I think, I don't know. There are connections being made in my brain once the character is there that wouldn't be being made if it was just in the abstract and had stayed in my mind.
Do you think it's to do with, you know, that principle of character-driven plot? Do you think you are somebody who creates the character first and then sees how they would behave and draws the plot from that?
Extremely. I took an improvisation course in London a few years ago because I had the sense that improv and comic writing were similar, and indeed they absolutely were. I did two courses with on a course called Monkey Toast, and I stopped at the end of the second term because I didn't want to perform. Well, I would have loved to, but I was too shy to perform. And that creation of characters and situation creates kind of incredible amount of story and possibility and just incredibly clever sort of verbiage that comes out of nowhere, that it just didn't exist 10 minutes before the skit began. And I think that's just, for me, that is exactly the same as making comics. I'm very admiring of plot-driven narrative. So Stephen King is one of my favourite writers, and I've read On Writing, and he talks about how he thinks of plots, and often that it's that he begins with a question, what if, what would happen if this? And I love that idea, but unfortunately, I have not yet been able to work like that. I have to start with a character.
Mm. It's interesting that you mention the improvisation that you did, because I think that's something that I really admire about you, that you are so creatively curious and that you dip in and out of lots of different media. And, you know, you did that improvisation course and you got really into sewing, and you still are a really voracious sewer, and you make most of your own clothes now, and you do life drawing and you read a huge amount and you watch a lot of things. And I feel that you have a very sort of global approach to storytelling, and maybe sewing doesn't fit in with storytelling, or maybe it does.
It does a bit, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of character stuff in a way,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Is that how you feel, that you see it quite sort of big picture creativity?
I mean thanks so much for saying that. I think I'm very aware that the stories that I can think on one hand of the stories that I'm truly proud of, because they feel they came to me, they weren't an imitation of something else, by which I don't mean that I'm not massively influenced by the media I consume. I think most of my stories are about the things that have gone in. I mean, that's obvious, but which I mean the books that I read often when I was young, or the films I saw, those are the things I'm sort of interested in referencing when I'm telling a story. But I sense that that's not where the starting point is, that I feel I have something to express. The starting point is that I'm trying to talk about something I've really enjoyed, be that a book or... and so I'm always looking for more things like that. So I think that's where the curiosity comes from.
And also, yeah, assimilating a lot of different influences. It made me think of a few years ago, I interviewed Lucinda Chambers, who used to be, I think at the time, she was the creative director of British Vogue. And I remember her saying that she had frustration with young stylists now, because she said they would show up to shoots and bring just other tears of other people's shoots. And she said the way she was trained to be a stylist was that you are bringing together, maybe you were inspired by something you saw at the theatre, and also by something you saw in the park, and also by a piece of music that you heard yesterday. And she said, you know, that creates much more interesting work, because you have just a much more sort of textured selection of inspirations that you're bringing together in an original way. And I feel like that's what you do with your work.
Yeah, I try to. I mean, I think I wanted, especially in the beginning of my career, I was always thinking about how to write an original story and what was a story that someone hadn't written, which I think is what we all think about. And then over the last sort of 5 or so years, it's become so, I've let that worry go. I'm not going to try and write an original story ever. And I don't think that's would be what my strength is. I think it's about interpreting through the characters that I can make a story that's probably been written a million times. And I think that texture you're talking about, is everything that goes into you, everything you've read. And if that's, you know, your particular love of Regency romances, as I do have, like, then that's going to come out in your work.
My impression of you as well is you're always very busy professionally, you're very in demand, but you're also, as far as I can tell, always sort of drawing and writing in a sort of just for the sake of it way. And the way it seems to me as an outsider is as though you're almost, it's almost like working out or going to the gym or something, and that I just feel that you are constantly practicing all the time and sort of keeping that muscle working. Is that how it feels to you?
Yeah, definitely. I think it took me a long time. I remember when I was going through my that time of finding myself in my 20s, and I always had a sense that drawing and writing could be the answer to the question that I sort of didn't know I was asking. And it took me until my late 30s to really realize that that was the case. And since I realized that drawing and writing was the thing that made me most peaceful, I want to do it every day. And also, yeah, it is a muscle. And frustratingly, even if I don't draw for 2 days, I can see the effect. My drawing won't be as good.
That's correct. I mean, you've said this to me before, and I find it hard to believe, but I do believe you.
It's absolutely true. And it might be less discernible to people who aren't me, but to me, it's extremely clear that I need to draw every day.
Yeah. So on a day when you are working on something that's, that you're writing as well as drawing, what's your kind of routine with it?
So, for example, at the moment, I'm trying to write a book of short gothic funny stories of comics. So I would start in the morning, I would try and just do some warm-up drawings, and then I just write bits of text next to whatever drawing I'm doing, and it's sort of working out characters, trying to work to see if I can make a story out of the disparate bits that I've got lying around. I work on A4 printer paper because typing doesn't feel as connected to, I suppose, because I have to draw and write at the same time. Typing kind of separates the two. I do it on printer paper because it's very, it's low status. So I don't have to worry about messing up a sketchbook or anything like that. So I feel like if I work on low status paper, I can start low status and hopefully get higher.
I like that. So it's a sort of less pressure.
Exactly. Okay. No pressure. Yeah.
Okay. And how many hours might you sit and work on something like that?
I think I've worked out that probably my creative time is the morning, and I can get about 4 hours done before I can't think anymore. And then in the afternoon, I'll do colouring work or drawing that doesn't require a lot of thinking.
Okay, interesting. And we're in your home right now, so you sleep upstairs and you just come down here and get to work.
I did. So for before the pandemic, I always worked in studios and or in cafes and libraries. I think the pandemic kind of got me out of the habit of doing that, and so I've made this kind of nest in my flat. I think for working, my flat is better. I love the studio for the social side, but also the social side will distract me because I can't resist taking off my headphones if I sense people are having a chat behind me. So it's better for my work. I think it's less holistically better for my life to be working at home. So at some point, I'll probably venture out again.
Yeah, it's such a difficult balance, that, isn't it?
It's really hard. It's really hard, yeah. I mean, there's no question that I'm more productive here, but I'm not sure it's always so good for me.
Yeah, I suppose it's a thing. I have the same problem because I work from home and I like I like peace and quiet and nobody bothering me. So it's perfect for that. But, especially if you're not going out in the evening as well, you can quite quickly start to feel quite odd, I think.
Yeah, you can.
A few days of that.
I get there's that sort of witching hour at about 4 p.m. where all the existential sort of angst kind of roils up. And it could just be that I need a banana, or it could be that I'm terribly distressed. I don't know which. It normally passes after about 20 minutes or a banana.
Right. And also I think it's, you know, it's all very well to say, well, you should go out for a long walk every day. But at this time of year, you know, some days I think, oh, well, I'm going to go out for a long walk later. And then it gets to 4 o'clock and I look out the window and it's like raining heavily and, you know, 8 degrees, and it's like, well, I'm clearly not going to go out for a walk now. No. So I don't know what the solution is to that.
I don't know either. I mean, I kind of feel like my walks were just an enforced part of my commute when I used to go to the studio, and the idea of making a circular walk and ending up back here is just monumentally pointless. So yeah, I don't know if you think of the answer to that.
The gym, I think.
I know.
Do you remember being, as a child, interested in making up stories? And if you were doing that kind of thing, was it, did it always go hand in hand with drawing, or were you somebody who used to write stories?
I did write a lot. I mean, I was an only child until I was 8 when my sister was born. So I spent a lot of time imaginative play. I had a lot of stuffed toys and Lego people that would kind of interact. So there were long stories with them. I can almost remember the painful day when I realized that fantasy play wasn't available to me anymore, that I was sitting on my bed and playing with two of my knitted rats I had, and they just suddenly, the dialogue rang hollow and I couldn't escape into their worlds, and I knew it was adolescence coming for me, which it was. Yeah, so I made up stories. I did write. I did some horrifying poetry in my teens, and I kept diaries. So writing has always been part of my play. And drawing went alongside, but I started writing comics and cartoons when I was in my teens, I think, and they tended to be quite angsty. There was one called Beauty and the Beast, in which I was the beast and the the boy I fancied was the beard. I mean, they were very self-indulgent.
But where is he now, I bet?
Well, I mean, actually, unfortunately, I know, but I won't. Okay. He's fine. He's not okay. Pining over me. Yeah.
Oh. And how, would you just talk me through how it sort of became your professional career?
I was so admiring of, there were some children's books that I'd grown up with, and notably was Maurice Sendak's work and William Steig, he was also a New Yorker cartoonist, and he wrote two books I loved called Sylvester and the Magic Pebble and The Magic Bone. And I knew that that was the kind of art I wanted to make, that although I loved fine art, and particularly I found the work of a surrealist, Leonora Carrington, when I was about 15, there was an exhibition at the Serpentine. I knew that the kind of art I was attracted to making was more narrative, and the only sort of avenue for that seemed to be illustration, and particularly children's books. So once I was told you could do a degree in that, that's what I did.
And you went to Kingston
University. I went to Kingston. So I went there in 1996 after doing a year foundation. And that course suited me very well. It was quite sort of strict. We had to be there 9 till 5, which I like, because I like rigor. And I don't know what I would have done if my friends who went to sort of more Ivy League, but like Oxbridge and stuff, they seemed to have so much time on their hands, which they'd spend eating sandwiches and punting along the river. And I think I would have gone mad with frustrated desire to be disciplined.
Right. So the first book that you illustrated was Pet Wash by Dale and Dodds.
That's right.
Is that right?
Yes,
in 2001. Yes. But then the next year you wrote and illustrated your first sort of book all by yourself.
That's right.
Which
very
was
exciting.
Called Ra.
Yes, that's right.
So how did that come about?
Well, so in our second year at Kingston, we did a project for a term which was based on the Macmillan Children's Book Prize, which they still to this day, they ran then. I'm not sure when it started, but it's still running to this day. And it was a very, the format for the entries was very similar to professional practice. So we had to do a rough book, which is just pencil sketches, a few finished spreads, which are the two pages, and a cover. And I did that, and I was a runner-up in the Macmillan Prize. And then when publishers came, because we were just outside London, publishers did come to our degree show, and Walker Books took my card and got in contact, and then eventually Ra became my first self-authored children's book.
Do you remember how that felt?
Isn't it maddening? You wish you could elicit those amazing feelings. I remember being incredibly excited. I was unformed at that age, at 22, and so I still, I wasn't taking myself sort of seriously professionally at that point. So I remember I had a lot of help from the designer and the editor at Walker Books. They were a wonderful place to start my publishing career, because at that stage they gave you a few books to sort of prove yourself with. And that was my second book. I was very excited. Speaking about whether texts felt like me or not, you know, I was very influenced by Bill Watterson and Calvin and Hobbes when I was starting out, as I think so many illustrators and cartoonists are. And that book was very, influenced by Calvin. And so I look back at it proudly, but I can see that I was just finding a voice.
In the last few years, you've done a lot more comics. So tell me, what's that experience like compared to, you know, when I first met you, which was a decade ago, you were doing quite a lot of children's books. You did the three brilliant Olive books. Was it Olive and the Bad Mood, Olive and the Embarrassing Hat?
And the Big
and Olive,
Big Secret.
Olive,
yeah,
and the Big Secret.
Yeah.
They're all great.
Thank you.
And of course, the Toucan Brothers.
Yeah,
everybody loves the Toucan Brothers. They're plumbers, right?
That's right. Yeah.
A lot of books that I gave to a lot of children in my life who, you know, absolutely loved them. But in the last few years, I feel that your focus has been much more on doing these comics. So what's the kind of difference between those two experiences?
They're very different. I loved starting my career in children's books, but I think I... unconsciously, there was a feeling of restriction that I didn't even realize I was operating under. But, you know, necessarily when you're writing for children, you can't, there are lots of things you can't discuss or that aren't relevant. And so when I started to realize I could write comics, and that feeling of being able to say whatever you wanted to, and that kind of anarchy and chaos and was incredibly freeing, and it felt like a release that I'd been looking for, and then freed me also to concentrate on children's books and what they're good at and the things, their strengths. I didn't need to kind of shoehorn in my unexpressed desires or anything into them. They could be what they are, whereas now I've got the release valve of comics.
Yeah, and you brought out Welcome to Audley in 2018, was it?
Yes, I think that was the Bog Eyed Books edition. I'd self-published a couple before.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, which is about two police detectives,
yes,
in a sort of creepy town where weird things happen.
Yeah.
Are the detectives a cat and a dog?
They're a rat and a cat.
Oh,
but lots
me.
Of people don't know. The cat is, I mean, the rat is fairly weird looking, yes.
And you have this ongoing slot in Phoenix?
The Phoenix, yeah. Magazine, comic magazine, yes.
Okay. But you also have, and I should mention you won the 2017 Observer Graphic Short Story Prize.
I did. That was seriously exciting, actually.
That
I can still
really
remember
exciting.
How that felt, yeah.
But you also put out a lot of work on Instagram, and now through Substack you've got this brilliant newsletter, The Repository.
Thank you.
Which I'll link to in the show notes. But you know, you're putting out work in lots of different platforms, and we always talk about, you've done some comics that have been more about sort of personal memories and things that have happened to you and so on, which I love, as you know. how does that, you know, you do have a lot of different avenues to put work out there, and how do those experiences differ, and what's it like putting something out online rather than publishing it?
I suppose that's the other big difference with children's books, is then when you're writing them, there's always, you're writing them for children, but children aren't going to be the ones who buy your books necessarily, you know, well, probably. So you have to get through a kind of intermediary in order to get to your intended audience, which has already been slightly selected by the medium you've put it out in as a children's book. With comics, I feel like you put them out and the audience finds them, the correct audience finds them. So I don't have to worry about who they're aimed at. I try and make a comic that makes me laugh, and I hope that whoever else it'll make laugh will find it. But I sort of don't even have to do that work. It's kind of great. I loved Instagram. I did three serialized long comics on Instagram, which were very much an experience of flying by the seat of my pants. The last one and my favorite, which was called The Temptation of Mr. Rose, I began because I just rewatched Black Narcissus and wanted to do a melodrama about a group of nuns. And that was really all I began with. And then slowly people started to read it and I had to keep going. I wanted to keep going. And the story sort of took its own journey in its own life. There's something low stakes about Instagram. It's the printer paper of of social media. You know, if I'd gotten bored halfway through, I wouldn't have wanted to do this, but I could have just walked away from it. And then as Instagram has become a less pleasant place to be, I've moved over to a Substack newsletter, which I'm really excited about because it kind of offers the place to do more writing and it feels more like a blog again. So again, and I just hope people, the right audience will find it. And if they don't like it, they don't have to read it. It's that feeling. I know that shouldn't be a reason not to ask people to pay for things, but at the moment it is, because the freedom it affords me that I'm just making something for me and whoever else might like it without asking them to pay. At this point, the freedom and what it does for my work is worth it. That might not always be the case.
What's it like when you're working with a writer and you're there as the illustrator? So obviously you have this brilliant new book out, The Book That No One Wanted to Read, which was written by Richard Ayoade, and you've done the illustrations. But I would definitely say, and I think Richard Ayoade himself has said, that, you know, you brought a huge amount of creativity to that, and you look at the illustrations and they're very funny, and they were from your imagination. So it's not just as though you're sort of working to instructions from a writer entirely.
No, well, it's a bit of both. I mean, you know, of course the illustrations are, a lot of them were suggested by him specifically. Some of them were interpretations of his text. I mean, it really depends. He was a very easy person to collaborate with, in the sense, I mean, we didn't have direct contact, as is normal when you're working with an author. But I certainly understood that he was receptive to ideas I might have. So it's an interesting experience, because you come up with ideas that you wouldn't have done if it had all just been out of my own head. So it's really valuable. And that book was such a funny and different text that I ended up drawing things I would never in a million years have drawn. So
it's brilliant. I really recommend it. What do you think your goal is when you're working? What are you striving towards? What do you want the experience to be for the person who's reading one of your comics or one of your books?
That's such a good question. I want them to find it funny, definitely. I want to translate whatever I'm feeling to the reader. But in truth, I don't think very much about the reader, because that's what I find inhibiting. I really just think if I draw it and write it and I laugh, then it's done. That's the best I can hope for.
Yeah. That's a good attitude.
Well, it's not from arrogance, obviously, as you know, it's from trying to keep that avenue clear as it can be. And that means not thinking too much about what other people are going to say.
And is there anything that, as a writer, you find particularly challenging?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think I'm quite good at... Yes, well, I've just thought of it. I suspect that I'm not very good at writing characters who aren't all more or less me.
But you're so entertaining. Who needs other kinds of characters?
Absolutely, Hattie. I think, you know, when I read a lot about writing and how people do it and how they think about characters who aren't themselves, and research, and I'm a reluctant researcher at best. I often think what my career would be like if Google image search hadn't come along at the time it did, because I don't think I could rely upon myself to go to the library and look up all the reference I would need to. So that's my huge weakness, is collecting, parsing research and writing things that aren't from my experience in that sense.
And can you think of any sort of breakthrough moments that you've had in your career where you've, I mean, I know that you are such a prolific reader, and you know, you and I are always talking about books that we've read about writing or podcasts we've listened to with various creative people. Is there anything that you heard somebody say or that somebody said to you directly that really clicked with you and improved your writing?
Oh, I feel like there's been so many, and of course now I can't think of any. I mean, I think a lot of it has just been reading things that reassure me that I'm not doing it completely wrong. I mean, one of the things was I went to Florida in August 2019 to study at the Sequential Artist Workshop that was set up by the cartoonist Tom Hart in Gainesville in northern Florida. And I think part of what I went for was a quest to find if there was some way of writing comics that I didn't know about. I thought maybe there was a secret. And I think finding out that there isn't a secret and that everyone else isn't doing it differently from me, because I came to comics late, you know, in my late 30s, I sort of felt like there was a club that I didn't know the password for. So finding that that wasn't the case was incredibly liberating, because it freed me to write comics the way I had been doing without questioning myself anymore.
And looking back over your career, and I suppose specifically thinking about your writing life, what do you feel most proud of?
Oh, I feel really proud of the Toucan Brothers, which I just think is so good.
It is so good.
I love it. You know, it's so easy to look back on your work and see how you do things differently. I might draw the toucans differently because I'm a 10-year more experienced artist now, but I can't fault any part of that story, which I just love. So I'm really proud of that. And I'm really proud of all my comics work, because I set myself a sort of, you know, fantasy goal about 8 years ago to become a comic artist and to know other comic artists. And I've done it. And I have a lot more I want to do, but I feel really proud of that, because it was nerve-wracking. And I felt like I was quite old. It horrifies me to say this now, but I felt like I was quite old to be getting into comics. And so I'm glad I did it.
Do you think it's taught you how silly those things are that we tell ourselves about being too old to do things?
It really does. I think I did a lot of that in my late 30s, and now I'm 45, and I'm always aware that anyone 10 years older thinks, well, just wait till you're, and I know that because I remember when I was 35 saying the same thing. But yes, I realize that. I hope I'm never going to beat myself with that stick ever again. Like, why not do it now? Why not do it in 10 years? I mean, it's crazy to let that be a reason not to.
Thank you so much to my dear friend, Tor Freeman. Please do look up her work. It makes me laugh so much. As mentioned, my favourites are the comics that she does about her childhood. So I'm going to link to one of my particular favourites that she posted on Instagram in the episode notes. I'm going to put a load of other useful links there too, including to her very funny Substack newsletter, The Repository, where she shares comics about her dog Rusty and an ongoing serial called Hell Boss, which is about a normal person who's been put in charge of running hell. And some of her books as well, including the recent one that she illustrated for Richard Iowardi. A reminder before we go of your exclusive discount code for the Writing School Curtis Brown Creative. Use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off the short online writing course of your choice. Visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. If you're enjoying the podcast and want to support it, then I would be very grateful if you would share it, either on social media or just by sending it to someone you know who might like it. And if you have time to put a review on Apple Podcasts, that would also be wonderful and helps it to find more listeners. That's all from me this week. See you next time.